So today we're going to start our program with Hugh McCready, and he's going to talk about groundwater hydrology, specifically modeling. And yesterday we had presentations on surface water hydrology and groundwater hydrology, including water balance. So this is another aspect of all that work. And you may wonder to yourself, what do we do with all this data? What is it? How does it relate to our project? And a good way to think about it is simply water balance. Water balance is basically simply the water into a system, however you define that system in terms of geographical area, account for all that water that comes as maybe precipitation, snow, rain, streams flowing in, groundwater flowing in. So that's the water in, and in theory that water out is equal to that. So the water that flows out of the system, and those two should balance. That's what we mean by water balance. So how does that affect, or why is that important for a project, like a mining project? Well, if you can envision changing the topography by excavating a pit in the course of mining, when you do that, all of that water is going to continue flowing. However, it will flow quite differently, possibly. And there's water used for the mine process itself. So when you do those kinds of activities, the balance of that water can change quite, become quite different. And so the studies that we do are to understand the current hydrology and the current water balance, and then work towards understanding how that might change. And of course, modeling is how you do those things. So I just kind of wanted to give a little explanation there, so that there was you can think about those things as we go through the information, because when you change hydrology, streams may change, and that may affect fish habitat. And you also saw yesterday when we look at hydrographs that there's quite a difference in the volume of water in the streams, even for every month of the year. You saw there are some real peaks and some real lows, so it's quite seasonal. So we have to think about all those things as we go through and develop a mine project, about how those things affect the surrounding habitats and environments. So with that, we'll welcome Hugh. Hugh McCready is a groundwater hydrologist and hydrogeochemist with a master's degree from the University of Waterloo. He has over 22 years of experience in assessing groundwater conditions at existing and proposed mines. He's an expert in field investigation techniques and in the practical application of three-dimensional groundwater flow and transport models to simulate regional groundwater flow, contaminant fate and transport, groundwater supply systems, dewatering systems, and environmental impact. During part of his career, he designed and delivered courses on groundwater modeling in 8 countries around the world. He has conducted groundwater assessments at existing and prospective mines in Canada, the United States, Peru, and Indonesia. Hugh joined the Pebble team in 2004, and he developed protocols and trained the field staff in field techniques for logging drill holes, installing instrumentation, monitoring water levels, conducting hydraulic tests, and collecting groundwater samples. Since then, he's been the lead hydrogeochemist for assessing groundwater quality and has developed the groundwater model representing groundwater baseline conditions at the Pebble site. So please welcome Hugh. He's done a great job, and let's look forward to his presentation.
Thank you, Jane, and good morning, everyone. I'm going to spend a little bit of time this morning talking to you about the groundwater flow model that we've developed for the baseline conditions at the Pebble site. First of all, an acknowledgement. I am working with Schlumberger Water Services on the groundwater model, and I want to acknowledge the dedication and incredible hard work of Ranjina Raman, who I worked very closely with at Schlumberger Water Services. So just a little outline of what we're going to be talking about. Start off talking about the objective of the model. I'll get into a discussion of what's behind the model, the concepts that are going into the model. I'll talk a little bit about our integrated modeling approach, in other words, how we've combined the numerical groundwater model and the water balance model. Then I'll get into the what I call the calibration process, and I'll explain what that means when I get there. And then I'll wrap up with a summary. This could be a painful presentation. We're just getting there. I think we're getting our line of sight to communication of the most with the computer a little sorted out here. Just one moment. Okay, I think we're good to go now. So the objective of modeling at this stage of the project was really quite straightforward. We wanted to develop a model that simulated baseline conditions. So what are we talking about when we talk about baseline conditions? Well, let's talk a little bit about the concepts that we're putting into the model. So sometimes I sit down and ask myself this question, really, what is it that we're trying to represent with the model? And I always try to come up with better ways of explaining really what that is and try to make these ways of explaining it as simple as possible. So this time when I answer that question for you and for myself, it really boils down to we have a bunch of geology that we've characterized, and you saw that in the discussions from Rod and Louise yesterday. We have some recharge characteristics, some groundwater recharge characteristics that we want to represent, and we got a bunch of rivers and streams and lakes and ponds out there. So really what we want to do is we want to take all that and put it into a model and then simulate the appropriate groundwater response. And when I say groundwater response, what I mean is really the groundwater elevations and also the groundwater surface water interaction. So in other words, the distribution of groundwater elevations in the near surface materials at depth with time, and then also the amount of water that is exchanged back and forth between the groundwater system and the surface water system. So in a very broad sense, this is what it looks like out at Pebble. We have a typical basin and range type of environment. So this is what we call the range or the ridges. And then under here, we have a bedrock valley, which is filled with a lot of overburdened material. And what we do is we go out and we do drilling investigations, do a lot of drilling, and collect samples from the subsurface and characterize those materials. And I'm just going to look at a very simplified conceptual cross-section through this valley. And it's going to look kind of like this. So this is the bedrock valley that we have, the mountain ridges. And then you saw this in more detail on Rod's slides yesterday, and here it is conceptually, that we have varying amounts of sand and gravel, clay or silt, silty sand, those kinds of materials. And it's basically a layered system. So we have these more permeable units separated by less permeable units represented by the green here. So in very simplified terms, that's the basic concept of the geology that we're trying to represent in the model, is this layered geological system. So these are the kinds of materials. I'm going to be showing a lot of graphs and stuff like that later, so I thought I'd relieve that with a few pictures up front. So we have these clay materials, and you can tell from looking at this that not very much water gets through this kind of material. Then we have more permeable materials like sands, even more permeable materials like gravels, and then mixed materials that are more like silty sands and gravels. So these are the overburdened fill that you find within the bedrock valleys. And then one of the things that Rod talked about yesterday is that fractured bedrock surface, the near surface bedrock that's at the top of the bedrock, tends to be kind of more broken, and you can see it in this set of core samples here. And so that horizon in the bedrock tends to be more permeable. So we want to represent that in our groundwater model. And then as you get deeper, then we have more competent bedrock. And you can see visually here that there's going to be much less water moving through this competent bedrock than there is through this fractured bedrock. So we have all these drill holes. We have a total of 293 drill hole logs. And I never intended that you could really read this, but basically what you can see here is that these symbols represent different kinds of material. And on this particular log, actually, you see the full range of materials that I showed on my previous slide. So then what we do to be able to represent this in the model is we simplify that geology. And what we did on this particular project is we created three types of materials. We called them type A, type B, and type C. So the type A materials, they are the most permeable ones. The type B materials, they're the intermediate permeability materials. And then the type C materials, they're the ones that really pass limited amounts of water. So we go back to our drill hole logs then, and we simplify that into our A's, B's, and C's, or in this case, the A's, C's, and B's. And you can see that what we've done is we've taken some of the detail out of the drill hole log and simplified it for the purpose of being able to represent it in a practical way in a groundwater model. So this is an example of a cross-section similar to what Rod was showing yesterday, and this shows the amount of detail that we put into our geologic and hydrogeologic interpretation. We have multiple layers of varying thickness, spread across the site here, and some layers are very thick. As here, you can see that's really quite thin. And then what we do with the groundwater model is we want to divide those into more simplified layers so that we can represent it in a pragmatic way. So you can see here that, for example, we combine these detailed geological layers into one model layer in the groundwater model. So what we did on this particular site is we represented the overburden with three layers. And then the fractured bedrock that's at the near surface of the bedrock, that's an important horizon for us, so we represented that with one layer. And then we had three more layers representing the deeper bedrock. So that was a thumbnail sketch of what we're trying to represent in terms of the geologic materials. And now I want to talk a little bit about the processes that we're simulating, or in other words, the groundwater response that I referred to earlier. So this is a representation of the Pebble site. And just to orient you, this is Frying Pan Lake. This is the headwaters of the Upper Tularic here. This is the headwaters of the North Fork Coctuli over on this side, just on the other side of this mountain ridge. And then this is the South Fork Coctuli River coming down through here. This is what we call the upwelling area in the lower part of the South Fork Coctuli. And then over here off the slide, that's the confluence of the North Fork and the South Fork Coctuli Rivers. And what I've done is to cut away part of the 3D representation here just so I can give you a little bit of a feel for both the surface processes and the underground processes. So our conceptual model then, as I mentioned before, is that we have a recharge going into the groundwater system. So I'm representing that recharge here with these wiggly arrows. And we have different amounts of recharge going in at different parts of the site. So this particular part of the site, this is where Rod was talking about, we have a lot of permeable outwash materials, and so there's a lot of groundwater recharge going in there, and I've represented that with larger arrows. Up here in the upper reaches of the South Fork Coctuli, close to Frying Pan Lake, on the lower flanks of this mountain ridge here, those materials are not so permeable, and it's a little more slope there, so we don't have quite as much recharge going in there. So what I'm saying is that part of our conceptual model of flow is that some areas of the site have more recharge, some areas of the site have less recharge. Then also part of our conceptual model is that there's groundwater flow between watersheds. And of course, there's also groundwater discharge. And as you'll see as I continue my talk, there's also places where water leaks from the channel into the groundwater system. So I really love this picture because it's not very often that you can see groundwater. For the most part, you have to take our word for it. But here you can actually see the concentric circles of the effect of groundwater discharging into this channel. This is actually the upwelling area that I noted on my previous slide. And one of the things that is very interesting about this site is that there is a great deal of groundwater surface water interaction. So another part of it is the groundwater elevations. And what we see here is one of the guys from SLR holding up a well screen. So this is what our monitoring standpipes look like. And those go in the ground like this, and we seal this screen into the horizon that it's intended to monitor. So this particular installation that I'm illustrating here, this is actually a monitoring site called MW1, has three installations. And so when we're monitoring our groundwater elevations, we have to consider not just what's going on in the near surface materials, but also in the deeper materials, because sometimes those water levels are really quite different. So when it comes to water levels and groundwater, there's really quite a lot to think about, because there's not only the water level change this way, there's also the water level change this way, because we have vertical components of flow in our system. And we monitor this set of water levels at the site with quite a vast network of piezometers, and each one of these dots here sprinkled around the site, that represents a monitoring location. And SLR would go out in their helicopter once a month, and actually are still doing it. And for the purpose of the groundwater model, we had 293 piezometers that were included in the groundwater model for our simulations. So when it comes to interpreting horizontal flow directions, then it's fairly straightforward. Water flows downhill. If we have one standpipe over here that's higher and one over here that's lower, then water is simply going to flow that way. And we come up with an interpretation of the groundwater elevations by contouring them, represented by these red lines here. This is similar to what Rod showed you yesterday. And then we also interpret the groundwater flow directions, which would be perpendicular to those red lines. So that's something else that we want to look at in the groundwater model. Are we generally replicating the pattern of these groundwater elevation contours? Then there's also vertical flow. So here I'm showing a simplified representation of some layered geology with a sand, a silty clay, a gravel, and bedrock. And this is the upper horizon that I illustrated a couple of slides ago. But then you can also have other things going on in deeper horizons. So here I'm showing a piezometer that is actually full of water and maybe even overflowing a little bit. And it's higher at this location than the water level in the shallow horizon. Over here, I'm showing the opposite. I'm showing that in this yellow layer, that the water level is actually lower than what it is at the same location in the shallow layer. So then if you draw a hydraulic gradient line represented by this light dashed line, then you see that you have something different going on in the deep horizon than you do in the shallow horizon. And that's actually something else that Rod illustrated really nicely on his plots over at the area where we have cross-boundary flow into the upper Telluric. That what's the water levels and the flow directions and the gradients in the shallow horizon were really quite different than what's going on in the deep horizon. And that's the sort of thing that we want to be representing in the groundwater model. So we can have this sort of thing. We can have water coming from deep horizons up to shallow ones, and then later on that can be going back down again. And just to break up the monotony of graphs and cartoons and stuff like that, this is what it looks like in the field when you have a deep horizon with a high groundwater elevation. Okay, so let's take a look at this in a little more broad terms and start to consider the groundwater-surface water interaction aspect of all of this. So I want to look at just a cartoon of a stream channel cross-section here. And so what we're going to have with seasonal groundwater elevations then is in the winter they'll be at their lowest. When the spring comes, then groundwater elevation will go up. And you see that our monitoring here, the water level goes up and down the standpipe, and then we can interpret what's going on in the broader sense here in other parts of the site where we don't have monitoring. Then in the summer, we have less recharge to the groundwater system, so the water level goes down again. And then in the fall, we have our fall rains. And then in the winter, we have our generally speaking, our lower or lowest water levels. So then if we plot that, it looks kind of like this. And so we're plotting groundwater elevation on the y-axis here, and we're plotting time on the x-axis. And each one of these dashed lines here represents 1 year. And so this is late winter, this is spring runoff, this is summer, this is fall rain, and then we repeat that pattern over and over again. And then as Rod pointed out in the examples that he gave yesterday, you have somewhat different response from year to year, depending on the amount of snowpack you have and the amount of fall rain that you have. So for the purposes of representing this in the model then, more specifically what we're trying to represent is two aspects of these changes in groundwater elevation. One is the range of elevation change, and then the other one is the average level of that groundwater elevation at that location. So now let's take a look at one potential pattern of seasonal surface water groundwater interaction. This is not the only scenario, but it's one scenario, and I'm making a point of mentioning it because we actually do have this scenario at the Pebble site, and it's relatively unusual in the field. So in this case that I'm showing here, it's a very specific example. I'm not saying it's everywhere, but this is a very specific example. We have an empty or dry stream channel, and you saw how those were mapped by HDR in some of the maps that were shown yesterday. And so there's no leakage here, and we have a groundwater table that's below the bottom of the channel. So there's no leakage from the stream into the groundwater system, and there's no discharge from the groundwater into the stream channel. Then during the spring runoff, the groundwater table comes up. It actually intersects the stream, and it starts discharging to the stream. And we have spring runoff, and so there's flow in the channel. During the summer, we can have the scenario where the water table actually goes below the channel, but there's enough flow in the channel from runoff to maintain a little bit of flow in the channel, but actually the direction of surface water-groundwater interaction is reversed. And in this time of the year, we have leakage from the surface water channel into the groundwater system. And then reversing again when we get the fall rain with the water table going up and runoff coming into the channel, and we have discharge into the channel and flow due to discharge and surface water runoff. So that's just one specific example of the type of surface water groundwater interaction that we have at the Pebble site. And let's take a look at this concept in longitudinal section now. So my cartoon of the stream channel here, we're just going to take a look at a cross section along here. And it might look like this. During the high groundwater table season, when we have a lot of rain, you know, when we're looking along the length of the channel at three different reaches, we could easily have discharge, groundwater discharge into that channel in all three of those reaches. And then during a low groundwater table time of the year, this reach here could conceivably, and actually does at the Pebble site, change from a discharge to a leakage reach. So these are the kinds of things that we want to be representing in the groundwater model. So I love these pictures. You saw a couple of these pictures yesterday, but I'm showing them again today just to show how it links into the groundwater model. This is the location that is just upstream of what I called the upwelling area on a few slides ago. And this is what that part of the channel looks like in early July 2005. And this is what it looks like by mid-August of the same year. So this is an example of a location at the Pebble site where we have sufficient leakage from the stream channel into the groundwater system that actually becomes dry. And this is what it looks like in a bigger picture. I took this picture from a helicopter, and you can see that there's quite a length of channel that is dry here. This is taken in August of 2005. And then a little bit further downstream, you can see that we're starting to get water showing up in the channel again as a result of groundwater discharge. So that's basically the kinds of concepts that we are rolling into the groundwater model, the kinds of things that we put into the model, and also the kinds of responses that we're trying to simulate. So now I want to talk a little bit about what I call the integrated modeling approach, where we're using both a water balance and a numerical groundwater model. So I'm always coming up with different cartoons of how to represent this. So 2012, this is the 2012 version of my cartoon. So with the water balance, then, we're representing both the surface water system and the groundwater system in Rod's water balance. And it's basically balancing buckets of water. And what we have is precipitation being fed into this balance, net of evapotranspiration, sublimation, and storage, surface water storage. Then some of that water is fed into the groundwater system, so it crosses this interface between the surface water and groundwater system. Then a portion of that water is routed to the next watershed through the groundwater system, but another portion of it discharges within that watershed, and we also have runoff, and then that generates the stream flow in the water balance. In the groundwater model, we have some parallels, but there's parts that are missing. So you'll notice here that in Rod's model, he's considering the complete hydrologic balance. And That's really what's so important, is that he's considering the complete hydrologic balance. Then what we do is we take the benefit of his recharge estimates that were developed by considering the complete hydrologic balance and feed that into the groundwater model. And so that's a parallel. Another parallel is the groundwater discharge that we simulate in the groundwater model. And then another parallel is that we also simulate the interwatershed groundwater flow through the groundwater system. The difference is that he represents this number as a single number. We represent it as numbers that are being fed through multiple layers. And the value of that is that what we're doing is we're testing whether or not this number can actually be accommodated given the hydrogeology of the site, given the hydrogeologic units at the site, and given the groundwater levels. So these pink circles here are highlighting the groundwater levels that we're simulating in the groundwater system, and that's another part of the test of whether these numbers here, the interwatershed flow, the groundwater discharge, and the recharge, are reasonable numbers. And then the water balance model keeps the groundwater model honest, because we're constraining the flows that we're simulating in the groundwater model according to the hydrologic balance. So for the purpose of doing the water balance and the groundwater model, you saw this yesterday, but I'll just review it with you quickly. Rod divided the site into several watersheds. So these orange numbers here, 1, 2, 3, 5, 4, and 8, are representing the South Fork Coctuli drainage. The green ones, 9, 10, 7, 11, are representing the Upper Tulare drainage. And then these blue ones, 12, 13, 14, and 15, are representing the North Fork Coctuli. And then we have other numbers representing outlying areas. And so this is a schematic showing the interwatershed groundwater flows that were assumed in the water balance. So some watersheds have simply one outflow, so area 3, Rod assumed just one outflow, but other areas have multiple outflows. So this is what we call area 5. And this is what we were talking about, the cross-basin flow into the Upper Tulare, in addition to this flow downstream along the South Fork Coctuli. So just to review what I was talking about here, our reasons for integrated modeling there are that by having a water balance, we are generating groundwater flows that are consistent with the overall hydrologic system, and this increases the uniqueness of the groundwater model. And then in the contribution of the numerical groundwater model is it checks the validity of the groundwater component of surface water interaction being represented in the water balance model. So just to give you a little bit more insight into how this all works, Rod's model is an analytical spreadsheet model. It considers the total volume by watershed, which includes the recharge and surface water-groundwater interaction. It does not consider the distribution of flows within the watershed. And it is calibrated to monthly stream flow. And he made the point yesterday of saying that his calibration is focused on the low flows. And the value of that for what I'm doing is that because his calibration is focused on the low flows, that means that his water balance is oriented around being a good representation of what's happening with the groundwater system. So then that's good for me, because, of course, what I'm doing is taking his numbers and using them to represent the groundwater system in my numerical model. The groundwater model is a numerical finite difference model. For those of you who are familiar with some of the software, it's the code called ModFlow Surfact. It considers total water volumes within each watershed like the groundwater model does. And in addition to that, it also considers the distribution of recharge and surface water-groundwater interaction in the watershed. And we have calibration targets, which include observed monthly groundwater elevations, the monthly flows generated by the water balance, and field measurements of the low flow stream flows. Jamie Cathcart talked about going out in the late winter and measuring flows in the streams to capture the groundwater component of groundwater discharge. And those are the field measurements that I'm referring to here. Heroic effort by HDR going out and doing that. I was really blown away. So here is a schematic then of how the water balance and the groundwater model contrast. The water balance recharge is applied as a total volume to each watershed. So each of these colors here then So, for example, this orange area here, we call this Area 5 in the South Fork Coctuli. And so the water balance is considering the total volume of recharge that's applied to that watershed. So just looking in the same area of the slide here, this is the same set of watersheds, but this is how the groundwater model represents it. So this is still Area 5 here, but you can see that instead of just one number for the whole watershed, we've actually distributed the recharge within the watershed. And here's a close-up of that. So the blues are very low recharge rates, the greens and yellows are intermediate recharge rates, and the oranges and reds are high recharge rates. So I happen to be showing here the recharge for May 2005. So what about the time period? Rod's model has inputs in terms of precipitation from January 1942 to December 2008. And that's important for him because he's generating all kinds of different scenarios with, you know, representing dry years and wet years and that sort of thing. His calibration period is from July 2004 to December 2008, and his simulation is divided into monthly periods. For the groundwater model, we have inputs and calibration for the period 2005 to 2008. And similar to the water balance model, we're also divided into monthly periods. So then what we're doing is representing the recharge then on a monthly basis. So what I'm showing here is a plot of total recharge on the vertical axis versus time on the horizontal axis. I'm not so concerned about these numbers here. Really all I wanted to convey with this slide is that we have high recharge in the spring and the fall, and sometimes zero recharge in some areas, or for all intents and purposes, zero recharge in the late winter, and occasionally in the summertime. It changes from year to year in the summertime. You can see in 2007 and 2008, for example, we actually had higher recharge than we did, for example, in 2006. Okay, so that's a big lead up. Let's actually start to look at how the groundwater model performed. So here we're looking at a slightly different plot. I'm still looking at recharge on the vertical axis and looking, instead of time, this time we're looking at the watershed area number on the horizontal axis. And we don't really have time to go into the details of all the transient responses of the model today. So what I'm showing here is the total recharge volume from 2005 to 2008 by watershed. So one of the things I talked to Rod about was, well, what do you think the uncertainty is in the water balance estimate? And so he came back to me with his estimate of uncertainty. And so what we've done here is to represent that uncertainty with these whiskers. So this bottom whisker and this top whisker then represent his estimate of what his uncertainty is in the recharge estimate. And so, you know, what we're saying is that, you know, when it comes down to representing the details of the groundwater system, the response of the multitude of piezometers and you know, distribution of groundwater discharge and groundwater recharge and all that sort of thing, if we have the recharge in the groundwater model nicely within the whiskers that Rod has specified, then we feel pretty good about how the groundwater model is performing. So the point of this slide here is that the pink dots are representing the water balance model, the blue dots are representing the groundwater model, and as you kind of scan your eyes across all the different watersheds, then the match between the two models is looking pretty good. So I feel pretty good about that. So let's talk a little bit about calibration targets now. What do I mean by calibration targets? Well, specifically we're talking about groundwater flows, and those include interwatershed groundwater flows, monthly net groundwater discharge, and in this case I'm talking about from the water balance, and also the late winter net groundwater discharge. In other words, what Jamie called the low flow measurements, which are actual field measurements of groundwater discharge. We also have groundwater elevations, which were again measured monthly in the field. So my point here is that some of our calibration targets are actually to be consistent with the water balance model, and some of our calibration targets are direct field measurements. And I keep harping on this maybe too many times, but I guess I'll say it one more time because it's on the slide, that calibrating to both heads and flows increases the model uniqueness. So just a quick review of our inter-watershed groundwater flow calibration targets. Just to remind you of what we're talking about here, this is the groundwater flow that's moving between watersheds through the groundwater system. And so here what we have is, this is the flow between watersheds through the groundwater system plotted on the vertical axis, and then this is the watershed area number plotted on the horizontal axis here. Again, the pink dots are the water balance model, the blue dots are the groundwater model, and again we find that the blue dots come within the uncertainty whiskers pretty nicely. Now, one thing that shows up when you do a groundwater model like this is that assumptions that you make about inter-watershed groundwater flow may or may not be exactly what you've assumed in your water balance estimate. At this point, we haven't put our foot down for our final interpretation of really which watersheds are receiving groundwater flow across their boundaries. So I've represented something else here in the green dots called groundwater model other watersheds. So these are flows that are going to other watersheds through the groundwater system that are not indicated in the, or not currently included in the water balance. So for the most part, and overall for the model, those are very small numbers. It's really only for Area 10 that it stands out as maybe something to look at seriously there. But for the most part, the flows to other watersheds are extremely tiny. So the next calibration target that I wanted to talk about is the net groundwater discharge. So just a little cartoon here to orient you around really what we're talking about there. This is the net flow that discharges to the surface water system. So again, we're plotting flow on the vertical axis. And again, this is for the whole simulation period. And we're plotting the watershed area number on the horizontal axis. And this is an important number because this is really what allows us to looking forward to when we're doing stream flow impacts for the mine or due to the mine, then you know this is something that we're really going to want to have a good handle on. And it's looking pretty nice here. Now, one thing that you'll notice is that this is a negative number here, and that's just indicating that there's more leakage into the groundwater system than there is discharge to the groundwater system in this particular part of the site. This is that Area 5 in the South Fork Cocktooley that we've referred to a couple of times. So then the next set of calibration targets that we had, these are the low flow groundwater discharge flow calibration targets, the ones where they went out there in the middle of the winter and brayed the snow and ice and really got some remarkably consistent flow measurements from year to year. So there's really quite a lot of these sites. They weren't all measured every year that they went out, but nevertheless, it's a very nice collection of low flow groundwater measurements. And just to illustrate what I'm talking about here, this is the average monthly stream flow at a station we call SK100B. So what we see here is, as Jamie pointed out in his hydrograph, that we have these peaks and then we have these valleys. And you can see these nice kind of asymptotically decreasing flows here in the late winter. And these are representing our what we call our low flow periods, where we don't have really any runoff into the system. And these numbers are really representing groundwater discharge. And so with these low flow measurements, what they're targeting is the very latest possible time that they could be out there to catch those flows before we get the spring runoff here. So I just wanted to put these calibration targets in perspective of the hydrographs that Jamie was talking about yesterday. So I'm going to look at this by watershed here. I'm going to look at it, first of all, for the North Fork. Well, I forget the order, actually, but anyways, it'll be the North Fork, the South Fork, and the Upper Tulare. And I'm going to show you a schematic and a graph for each of these areas of the site. Now, I've been a little bit unfair here. I've actually reversed the orientation, so we're actually looking south in this particular case here. This is Frying Pan Lake. And then this is the South Fork Coctuli down here. And then what I've done is I've cut away the ground here so that we can take a look at the conceptual groundwater surface water interaction in the North Fork here. So in the upper reaches, as Rod mentioned yesterday, we have leakage into the groundwater system. So this is what we call a losing reach. And then for pretty much the balance of the North Fork, we have discharge to surface water, or in other words, it's a gaining reach. And I really am impressed with the amount of flow that's there, actually. This is the North Fork Coctuli River on March 25th, 2008. I just want to show you that we're really not kidding. Even, you know, just in case you didn't believe the pictures you saw yesterday, I thought I'd show you another picture today. So this is the location of that station. This is called NKLF-4, LF standing for low flow. And also, to be convincing, I plotted the temperature here. The red and the blue represent the maximum and minimum daily temperature. And this is the date of the photograph that we're looking at. And sure enough, you can see that except for a couple of blips above freezing here, really we're below freezing the whole time. So just in case you didn't believe it yesterday, then here's even more evidence that really it is happening. So we're looking at a map here of groundwater discharge, and this is the same map that you saw yesterday, or a portion of the same map that you saw yesterday in Rod's presentation. These pink areas are showing where we have open water in March 2005. So in other words, that's a cold time of the year, it's late winter, there's no way that surface runoff. If we have open water there, then that's probably groundwater discharge. And so what we would hope then is that the groundwater model is showing some relatively strong groundwater discharge in the areas where we have open water. So in the case of the North Fork Coctuli River, for example, this is an area where we have open water, and the blue is representing relatively high groundwater discharge being simulated by the groundwater model. So now let's look at a cross-section through there. I'm going to show you a cross-section of flows along the length of the North Fork Coctuli River channel. And I have distance going from right to left just so that this graph is oriented in the same way that the map was. And the dots with the whiskers on this plot are the field measurements. And again, similar to the water balance, these whiskers are representing the uncertainty in these what we call low flow measurements. And so therefore, the modeling results, which are represented by the lines, if the modeling results are going through those whiskers in a reasonable way, then we feel that the groundwater model is doing quite a good job of representing the field system. So pink is 2005, red is 2006, blue is 2007, and green is 2008. And so this is really not a bad representation of what's happening with the groundwater surface water interaction in the North Fork Coctuli here. And we can see that we've got this characteristic losing reach here, we have a characteristic gaining reach here, and then it pretty much levels off. So now let's look at the South Fork Coctuli River. It's a little bit more exciting down there. There's more reversals of groundwater surface water interaction in the South Fork than there is in the North Fork. Starting off with this strongly losing reach in this area here. And then this is what we call the upwelling area here. This is where you saw the picture of groundwater discharge, that rare appearance of groundwater when you can actually say you're seeing it. So this is a gaining reach here. Then interestingly, a little bit further downstream, we have a losing reach again, but then it reappears again a little bit further downstream. So I don't know about you, for a groundwater hydrologist, this is very exciting stuff. So then this is what the groundwater model looks like. So this is that area where I indicated that it was strongly losing reach, so of course we don't have groundwater discharge in that part of the model. But then, sure enough, this is the part of the model where we have the upwelling area, and then I've overlain the open water from March 2005. And again, just to direct you to the color coding here, you know, the gray is virtually no discharge, the aqua blue is kind of an intermediate level, and the dark blue is high groundwater discharge. So sure enough, the groundwater model is simulating consistently intermediate levels of groundwater discharge along this reach here. Then this section of the river here, this is that part of the river where I said it was a losing reach again, and sure enough, we don't have any groundwater discharge from the groundwater model at this section. And then we get a little bit further downstream, and then this is again more open water down here, and sure enough, the groundwater model is indicating that we have groundwater discharge in that area. And then going over to the upper Telluric, you'll remember Jamie talking yesterday about this particular tributary to the upper Telluric Creek having about the same amount of flow all year round. He showed you those two pictures, one in the winter and one in the summer, and really you couldn't tell the difference. So that's another area where we have consistent groundwater discharge, and again, it's an area where we have open water, and again, you can see that the groundwater model is simulating groundwater discharge in that area. So let's look at the flow profile here, and along that cross-section, again, I have the distance going from right to left, just so that we're oriented in the same direction as the plan view. And sure enough, we have small groundwater discharges here. We have the dry section through here. Then we have that strong increase in flow downstream of the upwelling area. Then we have the losing reach, and then we have the gaining reach. So again, the dots are the field measurements along with the uncertainty whiskers, and the lines are the groundwater model. And then finally, Upper Telluric Creek. It's relatively more boring over here for a groundwater hydrologist. It's still exciting for fish people, but not quite as much going on for a groundwater hydrologist. In the upper reaches, it's gaining. And we have a small losing section here, and then it starts gaining here. I think with these arrows, I've maybe not quite represented this creek. I mean, really, it's fundamentally a gaining creek almost the whole way along. So this is what it looks like from the open water survey. You can see that there's lots of open water along the upper Telluric Creek along the whole reach here, and the groundwater model is sure enough simulating pretty consistent groundwater discharge all the way along there for March 2005. So again, we'll look at the flow profiles. The direction of the profile is this way and this way, so upstream is on our left this time instead of on the right, and the dots are showing a relatively consistent increase in flow along the creek, and you can see that the groundwater model is emulating that fairly nicely. Now, every now and again we have something like this, and not sure, you know, you look at a dot like that and you go, well, I'm not completely sure that that really happened considering that these flows were here. So that the groundwater model doesn't simulate that, I'm not too upset about that. I think this is doing a pretty good representation here. Okay, so now let's talk about groundwater elevations. So far I've been talking about groundwater model calibration in the context of flows. And that's really important because when it comes down to it, flows is really what it's all about. But if you have a model that simulates the flows nicely without simulating the groundwater elevations, then you gotta say, well, it's great that we have these flows, but we don't really believe this model because the elevations are not being simulated. So this is kind of where the rubber hits the road, is if you can get those flows to work out while also getting the elevations to work out. So again, just a reminder of what this looked like. We have these monitoring stations sprinkled all over the site here, 293 locations that we were representing in the groundwater model. And those water levels go up and down every year, every season really. And so that's what we're trying to represent. So Again, just to develop that idea of average elevation and range. So the red line in this case is a hypothetical example of a model result. And this particular model result has not done a good job of representing the average elevation, although it has done a good job of representing the range. So, you know, it's got one aspect of it. This particular modeling result has done a good job of representing the average elevation, but not the range. So it's got the other aspect of the modeling result that we want. And then this is a hypothetical representation of a model that is able to successfully simulate the average elevation and the range. So I'm going to look first of all at the absolute elevations, or in other words, the average elevations, and we're going to use a particular plot to evaluate that, where we put every single model value on the plot and we plot it against the observed value. And a perfect calibration would look just like this, where all of the observed values are exactly matched by the model. But if anyone ever shows you a graph like this from a model, then you know that they're lying through their teeth, because that never happens. So in real life, these plots look something like this, at least when you have a reasonable calibration. So you have some dots that are pretty close to the line, some are a little bit further away, and you have kind of a nice scatter around the line, and almost invariably there are one or two points that are a little bit stubborn and stand out. But in a good model, those will be very, 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 very small. You won't have very many of those points. So this is what it looks like in our model for every single observed value of groundwater elevation compared to the modeled value. So this is for our transient model with transient recharge from 2005 to 2008 for the whole study area for every measurement that was made every month between 2005 and 2008. So over on the right-hand side here, we have the three primary statistics that we track for evaluating the quality of the model calibration. And today I decided not to take the time to go into just explaining all the details of what those statistics are, but the results are good, I can say that. The residual mean should be close to zero, and it is. The absolute residual mean should be a relatively small number, and it is. The what we call the scaled RMS, or the root mean square error, is 1%. And that's a good result. You know, numbers that are less than 5% are generally considered to be fairly good results. So well, you can have good results like that when you look at the whole model, but if you look at the whole forest sometimes, then sometimes you're hiding a few sins. And so I want to look at the trees a little bit more closely with you, just to give you a feel for how we're doing in terms of some of the details. So let's take a look at the North Fork Coctuli in what we call Area 15. So again, we're plotting the modeled value versus the observed value here. And again, it's looking pretty good. And again, the statistics are really quite good. So that was one of the points that I'm making here, is that we made the effort to look at the groundwater elevation calibration in many different ways, so that we're doing the best job that we can in terms of representing those groundwater elevations. This is Area 7. This is the area where we have the perennial stream flow at about the same rate that we've been talking about a couple of times. So this area is not quite as good. You know, the plot here is not looking quite as beautiful, but it's still a pretty good result, and the statistics are still holding fairly strong here. Another example, Area 3. So this is the headwaters of the South Fork Coctuli River here, residual mean of 0, absolute residual mean of 11, and scaled RMS, or root mean square error, of 2%. So this is a very, very good result. So now I'd like to talk about the other aspect of groundwater elevation calibration, which is the range. So here I'm showing a comparison between the hydrographs, and in this case, when I say hydrograph, I mean the groundwater. Well, actually, I beg your pardon. I I'm actually not showing the hydrograph. What I'm showing is the change in groundwater elevation from the beginning of the hydrograph through time. So what I'm specifically targeting an evaluation of how well the model is representing the changes in groundwater elevation. And you can see that we have different results here. So on the far left-hand side here and on the far right, we have basically perfect fits between the model and the field observed values. And, you know, I could have just shown you those two slides, but, you know, that wouldn't have been fair. You know, certainly not every single location is as beautiful as these. There are some locations like this where, well, you know, it's a good representation, but if we can get more response out of the model in this particular area, then it would be better. Then this is the North Fork Coctuli. So at this location, MW60 and MW7S, it's really quite a good representation. At MW8D, this is an example of where the model is maybe a little bit over responding to the stresses in the groundwater system. And then finally, in the upper Telluric, it really is quite good. It's a little bit under responding here in this example. But these two here, it's really quite a good response. And that's important. You know, it's important that you not only represent the average elevation, but you always, you know, that you represent the range and groundwater elevations as well as you can. Because that gives you a different take on the groundwater system than just the average elevation. Okay, so I think that's probably as many graphs and numbers as you can stand for the groundwater model, so I'll wrap it up now and just summarize, first of all, our approach to groundwater modeling. And again, it's an integrated approach where we're using both a water balance that is using and evaluating lump flows in the complete hydrologic context, and we're combining that with a groundwater model which takes into account geology, groundwater elevations, as well as the flows. We're using transient recharge in the model from 2005 to 2008, and specifically we're using average monthly recharge. So in other words, every month from 2005 to 2008, there's a different rate of recharge going into the model. And we also distribute that recharge throughout each watershed. The geology in the groundwater model is based on quite a network of drill holes and interpretation as a result of the drilling. And the groundwater surface water interaction is an important component of our approach, where the water balance calibration emphasized the low flows from the continuous stations, and we used additional stations for measuring flows during low flow periods so that we could compare the groundwater model output with the measurements of those low flow periods. And finally, part of our approach is that we had monthly groundwater elevations at multiple depths, so representing both the transient response and the vertical differences in groundwater elevation. So there's really quite a lot to consider here. So then in terms of our calibration results, the interwatershed groundwater flows matched reasonably for most watersheds. The groundwater discharge matched reasonably for most watersheds. The low flows matched reasonably. And as importantly, the character of the losing and gaining reaches along the rivers matched well. The average groundwater elevations matched well for most watersheds. And in terms of the range of groundwater elevations, in other words, the transient response, some areas under or over responded somewhat, but we really had some excellent matches in many cases. So that is the groundwater model. Any questions? microphone?
Slide
65. I think I can. I'm not getting a mouse here. Somebody's messing with my mouse. You're going to do it? Okay. The elusive slide 65.
Am I on? Yeah, I like that. Okay, when we get to slide 65, I just wanted to point out to the group where the deposit is among these watersheds, just as a refresher for everyone, because in most of our presentations, it's shown with an outline. And so I want to do that real quick before we go to questions. Are we there yet? Yes, we are. So if you look at Frying Pan Lake is the best place to orient yourself for this project when you're looking at maps. So you can see there, Frying Pan Lake is there, where Hugh's pointing that out. And if you go straight north, you'll see a little small series of lakes side by side. There are three small lakes. Those are kind of the southern boundary of the deposit. And so from there, if you just draw a circle, the deposit is nestled in that kind of low-lying area between the hills there. So before we get to questions, I just wanted to point that out to everyone. And throughout the course of the meetings, when you look at maps, if it's not there drawn in, just go to Frying Pan Lake, go north, and you'll have that image for yourself. With that, we'll go to questions.
Phil North, Environmental Protection Agency. There's been a lot of investigation, and you had some nice pictures. Everybody's had some nice pictures of the connection between South Fork, Coctuli, and Upper Tularuck. And one of your slides showed a similar connection.
I'm sorry, one of my slides showed
a similar connection between the North Fork Coctuli and Upper Tularuck at the very headwater of Upper Tularuck. Do you have similar information about that interbasin connection as you do?
Now, are you talking about this area down here?
We can't see the slide anymore. There we go. No, yeah, that's the one that's been well investigated. And then you showed a slide that had a similarly double shaded arrow
right
between the North Fork Coctuli
right
and Upper Tularuck. And I'm wondering if that interbasin connection has been as well investigated.
Well, I would say it has been well investigated, yeah. I have the same information that everyone else is working with, of course, in terms of field data and drilling results and all that sort of thing. So I have the same information as everybody. And do I think it's well investigated? Do I think it's well understood? I think it's pretty well understood. And the point I was making today is that in our groundwater model simulations, that the model does successfully simulate that, and does it in a way that it's consistent with the flows and the groundwater elevations that are measured in the field. And so for me, that's kind of another brick in the wall that we're building to tell that story. You know, we're saying, yes, you know, we can simulate this with a model. So that's one thing that establishes that we think this is going on. And then, you know, Rod's work with his water balance and looking at all the flows, that's another thing. And then just the empirical evidence of the consistent groundwater flow there all year round. So, yeah, I think it's well understood, and it is consistent with what we're simulating in the groundwater model.
And right now you're talking about the North Fork Coctuli, not South Fork Coctuli?
Right now I'm talking about this cross-boundary flow between South Fork and this Upper Tularuck tributary. That's what I'm talking
about
at the moment.
But you had a slide that showed a cross-boundary groundwater flow between the North Fork Coctuli
and the headwaters of the Upper Tularuck.
Right.
Yes.
And do you, is that as well understood as the one you were just talking
about?
I
don't think it's as well established, but it's also a much smaller flow. So, you know, it was very, you know, it took more work down here, or we invested more effort down here because it was really a lot of flow, and it's in an area where, you know, channels go dry and that sort of thing. So we invested a lot of work down in here and considered it a lot. So right now you're referring to this link between, or this cross-boundary flow between the North Fork and the Upper Tularic headwaters. And so that's a much less significant flow. It's a much smaller flow. But it certainly does help to make things work better up here in terms of the water balance. So I don't think it's as you know, watertight as it is down here, but it certainly makes things work better up here, and we believe it is occurring.
The South Fork to Upper Tularic, I think you were talking about it being about 5 CFS. I don't know if that's an average or a high or whatever, but you said, so is the one from North Fork to Upper Tularic, what kind of flows are those?
Well, this one here, Rod, I think it's about 20, right?
Oh, 20.
Yeah, this cross-boundary flow is about 20 CFS. This cross-boundary flow up here is considerably smaller, like an order of magnitude smaller. Do you have a number off the top of your head? Yeah, so order of magnitude smaller.
Or
okay.
Less.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, good question. Any other questions?
I know it's kind of mind-numbing, all those graphs.
Okay. Thanks very much, Hugh.
Okay. Thank you.